Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Olivia Larson. I'm a philanthropy advisor at GiveWell, and we're really excited to be hosting this virtual event surrounding our work on malaria. GiveWell has allocated over $600 million toward malaria control and prevention over the last 10 years. Malaria definitely isn't the only thing we fund, but it's a major part of our grant making. And we've been really lucky to find and work closely with Malaria Consortium, largely supporting their seasonal malaria chemo prevention program. Seasonal Malaria Chemo Prevention, or SMC, is a program that provides preventative anti-malarial medication to children living in places where malaria is highly seasonal. This protects them from malaria during the period of high transmission, which is often the rainy season. I was actually able to go with Malaria Consortium on a site visit to Burkina Faso in 2019, where I was able to see the SMC distribution in action. It was incredible to see community health workers going out to try to knock on every door in Burkina Faso to give this potentially life-saving medication to children. For today's event, first I'll be speaking with the chief executive of Malaria Consortium, Dr. James Tibrandana. I'll then speak with two of GiveWell's researchers on malaria, Grace Holquist and Alicia Wang. We'll close with questions from the audience, so please drop any questions you might have in the chat during the presentation. We'll try to get to as many of those as we can. And as many of you generously support our work in malaria, we hope this presentation will allow you to get a better sense of what this support means in action and how you can feel confident in the impact of these programs. So let's jump in and welcome James onto the screen. Hi, James. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you very much, Olivia. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, so to start off, I thought it might be nice to learn a little bit about you. Can you share a little about your background and how you came to work in malaria?
Well, Ugandan, but a subtlety. I'm a medical doctor by training, and I've gone on to do epidemiology and really specialize in communicable disease control. How did I get into malaria? It's a long story, but to cut it really short, I was, you know, there's the classic. Everyone who's grown in a malaria endemic environment will have experienced it at least once or twice in their lives. I experienced it several times. So I'm fortunate that I survived that. But I think having had malaria and other diseases like hepatitis A, one of the things I really appreciated quite early in my life was the value of healthcare. Mm-hmm. And I grew up really valuing it and wanting to contribute towards, you know, a service that people can access. And so I went on to do medicine. And then literally, I think the public health impact, the public health problem of the disease just made me gravitate towards it. And ever since then, I've really been in the sector and trying to do as much as I can to really alleviate that suffering that many of us have experienced. But also, it would be a huge good to the world, everyone, whether you're in a malaria endemic area or not, if we got rid of this disease.
Yeah, and so before you were the chief executive of Malaria Consortium, you were their technical director. Can you tell us a little bit about your main responsibilities, both as technical director in the past and how that compares to your role now as chief executive?
Oh, that's it's fascinating. Maybe I'll start off with the chief executive and then go backwards. I think one thing that has changed between the two roles is sort of the audiences that I either work with or engage with regularly. As a chief executive, I think a key stakeholder that I now work frequently with is the board. Mm-hmm. As technical director, largely the technical team, the organization, and our external stakeholders, funders, partners, governments. But I think a key difference here is really working very closely with the board to provide the assurance of a charity like ours that's continuing to grow, but to see where we can both, you know, support the board to do their role, but also how the board supports us to be the organization that we want to be. Mm-hmm. I think another big element in this current role as chief executive is the strategy and thinking about the future. Where does Malaria Consortium want to be? And when I say consortium, I don't mean just James, I mean the entire organization. where do we want to be over the next 5 years, and how can we get there? And that's something that happens collaboratively by working with, you know, internally, but also working with external stakeholders like yourselves, who are very important and really operate like partners to us. As technical director, a lot of my work was working with the technical team, ensuring that the implementation quality and the technical quality of our programs was top-notch, making sure we had a pipeline of programs, the operational research, and how that research gets shared with stakeholders like yourselves to be able to provide the funding that we need for our programs. And then I think probably as chief executive, you sort of carry the brand. So I'm very conscious about how I'm doing that in my conversations, as well as the interactions that I have with all the stakeholders.
Well, this interaction seems to be going great so far. And so taking a bit of a step back, why does Malaria Consortium work on malaria?
So it's in our history. In 1994, Malaria Consortium started off as a collaboration between the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. And they came together to provide technical support to the UK government's development arm, at that time called DFID, now called FCDO. So it started off as a resource center providing support in terms of how the UK government was spending its money on malaria programs and how it was designing and evaluating those programs. And then in 2003, a decision was taken to turn Malaria Consortium into a UK charity. So I think it's the history, and then the fact that when we turned ourselves into a charity and our founders put together a strategy, the strategy, one, took account of our history, but took account of the public health burden that malaria was having. And so the ethos was that how can Malaria Consortium as a charity provide additional support to programs in Africa and Southeast Asia to really have impact? And what we found is that malaria is that entry point. One, you know, a child may have malaria today and tomorrow has pneumonia or something else. Adults do have malaria, but have other diseases. And then the platforms that we use to deliver malaria commodities or malaria services are the same platforms within the health system that provide other services. Mm-hmm. So it's a really important entry point into the health system, into the enormous burden that communities are facing. And also, it really has a case that allows us to sort of make the compelling argument for funding our programs.
Yeah, and what is the overall burden of malaria and who does it largely impact?
Burden is huge. And I'm sure all of you, you know, have seen the statistics, you know, over 200 million cases, you know, more than 600,000 deaths in the World Malaria Report of 2022. And that's because of all the efforts that we've taken over the last sort of, you know, 20 years to bring it down. But I think what this, you know, to contextualize it, you know, in the real world setting, a child that is growing up in a malaria endemic environment will experience anywhere between one to about three episodes of malaria in a year. That sort of brings it to life. And then when you think about, you know, the deaths and the number of deaths that are occurring in these countries, it's sort of substantial. So that's the burden. And that's the burden that is measurable using, you know, systems, usually modeling. It could be more, because when you look at the confidence intervals, there's also a range around that. And that burden is distributed not globally. Almost 90% of that burden takes place in sub-Saharan Africa. The risk is in, you know, there's a risk of malaria in South America, there's a risk of malaria in Asia. But when you look at the burden in terms of deaths, 90% of that is taking place in sub-Saharan Africa. And it's children under five and pregnant women who are really carrying that burden.
And what are the symptoms of malaria and the costs of malaria on those families, other than the mortality, of course?
So fever is your classic symptom. You know, headache. You know, children at that young age are not able to sometimes express themselves and say, I have a fever. So you find a child being very weak, losing appetite, you know, crying all the time. And that's the version we call simple malaria, all right, and or uncomplicated malaria. Mm-hmm. And then when you move to the severe end of the spectrum, children, adults become unconscious. Children have very low oxygen carrying capacity in their blood. So you find a child is very anemic and is not able to have enough oxygen. And so, you know, they're breathing difficulties, breathing very rapidly. When you look at the child's eyes, absolutely pale. And then there's a host of other things like kidney failure. And you know, even in the coma, sometimes children who lose consciousness start to experience loss of cerebral function as well. So there's the simple side of the spectrum, which you say is fever, headache, muscle aches, you know, loss of appetite, to the very end of the spectrum. And then the very end, unfortunately, which is mortality, death.
Yeah. Bad.
I think you had another part to that question.
Yeah, it was a kind of, is there the economic cost?
Very important. So, there's a review that has been done recently, and you know, it says, look, we need to do more research on the economic cost. But when you look at some of the studies, an uncomplicated episode, you know, the simple one that I've spoken to, will cost a family in dollar terms anywhere up to about $10, you know, $20, depending on, you know, access to healthcare, you know, whether there's a cost in the health system that they have to incur, sometimes whether they have to go to the private sector. When you get to severe malaria, all right, we're talking about $100, $200 for managing one episode. And if that gets into things like, you know, kidney failure, loss of consciousness, you know, there's even subsequent, you know, people have to go to health facilities, you know, several times. It could get into the hundreds of dollars and probably even a thousand. So that's the spectrum. Now, that's direct costs that come out of the pocket. They're the indirect costs. The fact that a mother can't go, you know, to the farm, a parent has lost productivity because they're not able to go to work. There's costs like children not being able to go to school, and these costs don't really get captured sometimes, but that would be the spectrum of direct costs that people have to incur. And remember, these are households where that cost may be anything to about, you know, their monthly income, maybe, you know, just half that cost, maybe half of what they're earning in a month, especially in very, very poor households.
Yeah. And so I mentioned that GiveWell supports Malaria Consortium for your SMC program, which is providing this preventative antimalarial medication. How much of Malaria Consortium is focused on SMC, and how do you decide how to prioritize between your different programs?
So that's probably changed over the last 5 years. And I would say that more recently, about 60% of what we sort of spend in terms of spend terms will be SMC related, either philanthropic funding or funding from the Global Fund as well. And really, I would say that you know, quite a lot of our effort is in making sure that our SMC program really achieves the optimal impact, making sure we have the right data, making sure we're doing the right operational research, and working with our partners to really ensure that the quality of the programming is as high as we can make it. So I'd say roughly, I would say something about 50 to 60% of what we do is SMC related, you know, broadly. In terms of how we make decisions, I think we're not, let's say, as quantitative as GiveWell is, but I would say we start off by understanding the burden of disease in a particular location. What are the major causes of illness in the particular target groups that we're looking at? And then the other element is, the WHO recommendations. What recommendations has WHO put out there that provide the normative guidance that countries are working with within their policies? Because we try to operate within the policy framework as well as within the WHO guidance. It doesn't mean we can't operate outside, because our operational research is there to sort of ensure that we're informing and improving those policies. And then you get down to things like feasibility of our programs, the fact that are these programs feasible in the context in which we're operating? And then there's some other variables that kick in, you know, some of the cost effectiveness analyses that you do. And importantly, the ability for us to get funding for our programs. That has an impact on our decision making as well.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, digging into SMC a little bit more, since this program is something that many GiveWell donors support, either directly or through our top charities fund or our all grants fund. I'd love for you to talk through a little bit of what SMC delivery looks like in action.
Yeah, it's I think so. It's a big program, and there's a lot of planning that goes into it before, you know, a child does receive the medicine. There's the huge macro planning, making sure that we have the pipeline of medicines arriving at the right time, and then making sure that we're able to get the right numbers, because having the numbers and ensuring that you're, you know, getting the right number of drugs in the right place is a critical element. And then at the micro level, then all the planning that has to go into the campaigns, as well as the engagement of communities. So that's a whole set of activities that take place. And then when it comes to the actual, you know, delivery, there's a lot of work that goes to make sure communities are ready. You know, the communication, the engagement with community leaders, engagement with communities. You know, sometimes there's people who have to go into the community and announce that on this particular day, people are going to be coming to your homes. And if people have any concerns, you know, having those conversations to really ensure that acceptability is high. And then with all these trained cadre of community health workers, community distributors, you know, community mobilizers, is that then you have people going to households, you know, introducing themselves, how are they identified, and, you know, talking with the families, identifying, taking records of the children in the household who are going to receive SMC, listening to the mothers if they have any concerns about the medicine. And then one of the things we've had to adapt because of the COVID pandemic is that the medicines get given to the mother, who then administers the medicines to the kids. We have to make sure that, you know, the things are in place, the cups that they're going to use, you know, the spoons, the clean water that's available, that tends to come from households. But all that has to be in place so that when that time comes, that mother can then administer the medicines. You know, it's put on a spoon, dissolved with a little bit of water, and then the child takes the medicines. It's observed to make sure that the child takes the medicine. If anything happens and the child, you know, vomits the medicine, then depending if it's within like about 30 minutes, then a repeat will have to happen. Otherwise, when that's completed, the community distributor, you know, takes their records, puts a mark on the door to show that that child has received SMC, and then says bye and moves on to the next household. So it's an engagement process, and one that really is collaborative with the households.
Yeah, and SMC is something that usually happens in the summer because that's the season of high malaria transmission. So is it happening around now?
Yes, it is. So yesterday we finished the last cycle, which is, so you have, each month is called a cycle. And then when you put the cycles together, if it's four or five, then you have a round. Mm-hmm. So yesterday, the round for Mozambique came to an end. Mm-hmm. And so we're very fortunate that we were able to achieve that successfully. At the moment, there is the first cycle taking place in Uganda. And some of that is supported by the Global Fund, but some of that is also supported through philanthropy as well. And then between June and November, we will be having SMC taking place in other countries, you know, Chad, Togo, Nigeria, South Sudan, and Burkina Faso.
Well, it's exciting that it's happening now. So when we were talking a little bit about your role as chief executive, you talked about the strategy that you're working on. And so my last question for you is, what do you expect to see in the next few years for Malaria Consortium?
Well, we're midpoint in our current strategy. And in 2025, we should be rolling out our new strategy. So I think an important thing to look out for is our new strategy. We're 20 years this year. So later this sort of, hopefully before the end of the year, we shall be marking 20 years of our existence. But I think what you should expect from Malaria Consortium, I hope, as chief executive, there's a lot of work we have to do, talk internally as well as externally, is an organization that is really bold, agile, trying to see how we can have more impact with what we have. So trying to be bold, bigger, better, faster. Chemo prevention will continue to be something that's very important to us, whether it's seasonal malaria chemo prevention or some of the other chemo preventive interventions. We do feel that's an important contribution towards the journey towards malaria elimination. So that's something that will continue to be important to us. And I think as chief executive, I'd like to see how we can even absorb more and do more in that space, because the demand and the need is still great. Mm-hmm. Malaria elimination will be a core part of our work. I think I'm one of those who's really passionate, as I said, in terms of how we really get rid of this disease. So an organization that will be focusing on a couple of things, doing them well, but also trying to ensure that we remain integrated, we remain partners that can complement the things that are taking place around the world, whether it's malaria, whether it's our contribution to universal health coverage and research as well.
Those are some big plans, and I'm excited to watch them hopefully come to fruition. Thank you so much for answering all of those questions. There's a lot to dig deeper into, and I'm excited to do so in the Q&A portion later. So a reminder, if you have any follow-up questions, to put them in the chat, and we'll get to them after I talk to my colleagues, Grace and Alicia. So Next up, I'm excited to be interviewing Grace Holtquist, my colleague here at GiveWell, who focuses on grant making to GiveWell's top charities working in malaria control. We'll focus this discussion on GiveWell's role as a grant maker funding SMC specifically. Hi, Grace.
Hi, Olivia.
What's the history of GiveWell's support of SMC? How did we find it as an intervention?
Yeah, so GiveWell began supporting SMC through Malaria Consortium in 2017. And in that first year, our funding for SMC was pretty limited. It supported a target population of around 600,000 children. But as James mentioned, that funding and the target population of kids that it has been supporting has grown pretty substantially in every year since. So last year in 2022, GiveWell funding supported a target population of around 16 million children across 7 countries. And that includes countries that have delivered SMC for many years, and also countries where SMC is a new intervention that Malaria Consortium is piloting.
That's really exciting. Why does SMC look so cost-effective, especially compared to other malaria programs that might plausibly be as good?
Yeah, so GiveWell sees the case for supporting SMC pretty simply. As James said, we know that malaria is a major driver of child mortality in sub-Saharan Africa. And we also know from many high quality studies that SMC is very effective at preventing children from contracting malaria. So reduced malaria means reduced risk of malaria mortality, but also reduced risk of the additional morbidity and economic costs that James was talking about earlier. And finally, the reason why it looks so good in our cost effectiveness models is because SMC drugs are inexpensive and are delivered through these large health campaigns that are really, really good at reaching a lot of children, SMC is a pretty low cost intervention, costing just around $7 to reach a child with a full course of SMC drugs.
Very cool. And so because this program is so cost effective, GiveWell recently made our largest grant ever to Malaria Consortium's SMC program. So I want to shout out to the donors who supported this $87 million grant. That was funding from GiveWell's Top Charities Fund at the end of 2022, as well as effective altruism groups from Germany, Switzerland, the Netherlands, and New Zealand. Grace, can you share a little bit more about our decision to fund this grant and where it will be able to support this preventative anti-malaria medication being distributed to children?
Yeah, first, just to echo Olivia in thanking all of the donors who supported this grant, and also just to say how thrilled we were to be able to make the grant to Malaria Consortium, which is such a valued partner that does such incredibly impactful work. So this grant was a renewal of support that we have been providing to four countries in the Sahel, which is a region of Africa where SMC has historically been delivered. So the majority of the funding from the grant will support another year of SMC delivery in Nigeria, which is the largest country program that we support. GiveWell funding supports 8 states in Nigeria and a target population of around 11 million children per year. So a big part of investigating this grant to come to a final decision was closely reviewing Malaria Consortium's reporting from the previous year of SMC delivery, so that the 2021 program year, and using the information that they had shared about the number of children that they had reached with SMC and how much it costs to reach those children to update our cost effectiveness model so that it was using the most up-to-date evidence available on how Malaria Consortium's programs are actually performing. So just to say again how thrilled we were to be able to make the grant.
Yeah, and sorry, just as a reminder, how does SMC prevent malaria?
Yeah, SMC is given to children once a month. It's a 3-day course of drugs. And then those drugs, if they're working well, remain at such concentrations in the children's blood that even if they come into contact with a malaria-infected mosquito, there should be a high enough concentration in their blood of this prophylactic drug to be able to prevent them from actually falling ill. Mm-hmm.
And so when we're thinking about where to support SMC, how do we prioritize between different countries or decide where we want to fund?
Yeah, great question. So we don't think that SMC is equally cost effective across all countries where it could be delivered. We have country-specific or sometimes even region-specific cost-effectiveness estimates in our models. And the three main drivers of why there would be different cost-effectiveness estimates across locations are malaria burden. So some populations in different locations experience more malaria than others. The cost to reach a child with SMC. So some contexts are more expensive to deliver in or more difficult to deliver in. And then also the likelihood that another funder would support this program if GiveWell did not. So we really try to focus on supporting countries that we think are very unlikely to have enough money to deliver these programs to all the children that they want to if GiveWell doesn't step in and offer more support.
So you mentioned that we think about what other funders might be making decisions and incorporate that into our decisions. Who are those other major funders and why can't they step up and, you know, along with GiveWell, fill these SMC funding gaps?
Yeah. So the other major donors of SMC are the Global Fund, which is a big multilateral that raises funding for HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria programs from wealthy country governments. And then the President's Malaria Initiative, which is a part of the US Agency for International Development. So these two donors provide the vast majority of malaria funding that is spent globally. And they support a ton of other malaria prevention and treatment interventions. The funding that they are able to raise has not been sufficient to cover the full at-risk population with all of these really important interventions. And so country governments who are the recipients of this money are often having to make really, really difficult decisions about where to cut funding from even key interventions. This has become sort of even more acute of a problem recently because the funding needs to fight malaria have been increasing due to inflation, population growth, the introduction of new and more expensive interventions, but the funding that these bodies are able to raise from wealthy country governments has sort of plateaued. So this is a real shame because, as we've been discussing, many of these interventions are highly effective at saving lives. And so we're really dedicated to raising as much money as we can to filling what these two other funders are not able to do.
Yeah, philanthropic support seems like it's unfortunately really important. And so we're very grateful to our donors for supporting that. So thank you so much, Grace. Now I'm going to ask Alicia to come on and share a little bit more about how we find new potential programs to support in malaria. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Olivia.
Historically, GiveWell's core malaria interventions have been SMC and malaria nets. So how do you think about, or how do we think about funding malaria programs that we haven't yet supported?
Yeah, so even with great success with SMC and NETS, there remain 600,000 malaria deaths a year. As Grace talked about, SMC and mosquito nets are highly effective, but they also have their limitations. Nets are really effective when used, but coverage and usage remains a challenge in a lot of settings. Similarly, SMC is highly effective at prevention, but it's only suitable for certain settings where malaria transmission is highly highly seasonal. And so we think there are a lot of opportunities to keep funding our SMC and NETS work and expanding those. But in addition, I think also a ton of opportunity to explore other interventions alongside SMC and NETS that keep reaching more people, better target the most vulnerable populations, or can provide more robust protection for people who aren't fully covered by SMC and NETS.
Yeah, and one of the things in this category and intervention that people are pretty excited about is the malaria vaccine. And so that's a relatively new development in the malaria space. And we made an exciting grant to support that vaccine rollout last year. Can you share a little bit more about what that grant was and how it's been going?
Yeah. So for people who are not as familiar with the vaccine, it's a vaccine called RTSS that protects against malaria. It's given over 3 or 4 doses over the first couple of years of a child's life. It's really exciting. It's like scientifically groundbreaking, but also limited in its effectiveness. So trials suggest it's only 30% effective at reducing malaria among young children, which is significant, but that's in contrast to other vaccines where we're used to seeing 90% effectiveness. So it's not a panacea, but it's a really valuable tool to be used alongside bed nets, SMC, these other tools to prevent malaria. Mm-hmm. So last year, GiveWell recommended a grant of $5 million to this great organization called PATH to support Malawi, Kenya, and Ghana's ministries of health in the implementation of RTSS through the end of 2023. So this includes costs of providing technical assistance to the government for the launch, training healthcare workers to deliver the vaccine, as well as shipment of the vaccine and procurement of injection supplies that are needed to give the vaccine. So the vaccine was scheduled to be rolled out in these countries in 2024 with support from Gavi, who's the main funder globally of vaccine procurement and delivery. And we believed our grant would lead to a 1-year speed up of the rollout. So the impact would be from an additional 1-year coverage of children with the vaccine. And distribution is now happening in all 3 countries. So PATH has completed training of healthcare workers and launched implementation of the vaccine. And it's on the schedule that we had initially projected. So very exciting to see children getting vaccines in all 3 places.
Oh, that is exciting. Are there other malaria vaccine opportunities that we are considering funding?
Yeah, so I think the most promising category of opportunities is more grants to accelerate rollout of the vaccine across more countries. There's currently funding going into the procurement of vaccines themselves through Gavi, but a need for more funding for actual implementation and setting up the systems on which malaria vaccines would be delivered. In addition, there's not enough supply of RTSS to meet global demand for the vaccine. And so there's another vaccine for malaria that's currently in development, being tested in phase three trials called R21 that could help address the supply issue. So we plan to keep up with developments on R21 and see if there's room for us to kind of plug into that space and accelerate the rollout of that vaccine as well. I think another category of opportunities is to help enable a healthy market for these vaccines to ensure that doses are allocated efficiently to places that need them and that prices remain low.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hope that we find some good opportunities in there. So when we're thinking about these newer type of grants, how do we measure success when it's not as straightforward as it might be with SMC?
Sure. Yeah. So so we'll often have, at the time of making the grant, we'll make forecasts on what the forecasts for key indicators or milestones that kind of need to be hit for the grant to have the impact that we project. So then we follow up with grantees regularly to track that these grants are hitting those key milestones. And we'll often ask grantees to collect monitoring data for key indicators that input into our cost effectiveness models. So for example, for malaria vaccines, we were looking at, the impact of the grant is really from accelerating delivery or rollout of the vaccine. So we looked at, was this incorporated into countries' strategic plans in the time that we expected? Was training completed on time? Were the vaccines and key supplies procured and delivered on time? And then ultimately have vaccines actually been delivered? Mm-hmm. So we'll also look at estimates of coverage. So in this case, it's data that's integrated into routine vaccine coverage reporting. But in other cases, we'll ask grantees to collect pretty intensive independent data on monitoring to check that we're actually reaching the number of people that we expect.
Great. Yeah. Thank you so much for all of this, Alicia. It looks like we have a lot of audience questions coming in. So I'll invite James and Grace to come back on screen and we can get started. Welcome back. So the first question from the audience is about something that is following up on something that James mentioned surrounding working with communities and making sure that people who are receiving SMC for their children are comfortable receiving it. So this person asked, what proportion of the target households don't accept the medicine at first? And what are the kind of common issues that are run into there? And if there are any steps that you can take to promote acceptability or make it more likely that a household will be excited about receiving this medication?
Okay, I'll start the answer from when we first really took, because there's a lot of research that went into SMC at the outset. And when we're really thinking about SMC in the implementation setting and the scale up, and we sort of took, the tools to a state in Nigeria and made all our plans and went out into the field. Mm-hmm. We got more children coming for SMC than we had planned. We ran out of drugs. Wow. SMC is hugely acceptable. The acceptance rates are very high. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think when you imagine the burden that families go through and the impact that they see as a result of this intervention, whether it's in the Sahel, whether it's beyond the Sahel, the consistent issue is high acceptability by communities. Now, there will be, as we know with all things, there will be those who struggle to accept. And some of that has to do with things around safety, if our engagement approach, working with our governments and our communities was not, up to the standard that we would usually expect of that, then you will have some populations that may not be prepared, not be aware, households that may not be in at the time when we go there. But I think consistently the acceptability rates have been high.
Mm-hmm. That's great to hear. I think this next question might be for Grace, surrounding what are the indicators of success that we look for when we're evaluating an SMC campaign?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Malaria Consortium conducts coverage surveys after each cycle and round of SMC that it supports. And so surveyors go door to door visiting a random sample of households that should have been reached by the SMC campaign, and then asking those households questions about whether they were indeed reached and sort of what was the quality of services received. Mm-hmm. So we review the reports from these surveys in depth, and we use their results to update our cost effectiveness models. So specifically, we use the sort of headline coverage rate that is measured by, so let's say in this state in Nigeria, they measured an 80% coverage rate. So we use that to adjust our estimates of how many kids are being reached. So it feeds directly into the decisions that we're making.
That's great. And Grace, we were getting one question around what like proportion of SMC costs are funded by GiveWell. How, maybe this is either for James or Grace, surrounding how much has GiveWell and GiveWell's donors allowed Malaria Consortium's SMC work to grow?
Sorry, Olivia, do you mean the proportion of the SMC that Malaria Consortium delivers that is funded by GiveWell, which I might let James answer, or the proportion of the costs of the programs that we do support that we are covering?
More of the former, I think.
Okay. I might kick that over to you, James.
Okay. So over the last year and 5 years, from GiveWell directed funding, we've been able to absorb about $370 million for SMC and a bit of NETS as well. And in terms of SMC GiveWell directed funding into Malaria Consortium as a whole organization, I would say that more recently, something like 50% of either our income or our expenditure is associated with GiveWell directed funding for our SMC, and as I said, a little bit of net activity. So for us, I think philanthropic funding has been hugely important. And over the last 5 years, that has literally, in terms of the proportion, doubled, whether it's our expenditure or our income. But we are seeing Global Fund as, you know, one of those major funders for SMC, specifically in Nigeria, that is beginning to really crowd, not to, to take on that proportion that, as you were discussing earlier, GiveWell, you know, catalyzes and assists to ensure that other donors are able to come in. But please, the thing we must remember is there's still a gap mm-hmm. out there of children in the Sahel and in other parts of sub-Saharan Africa where malaria is seasonal, where some of these drug-based interventions can still have a role to play. So we still have a gap that needs addressing.
Yeah, thank you. Switching gears a little bit, somebody asked about a little bit more about what Alicia mentioned kind of at the end about interventions to work on enabling a healthy market for malaria vaccines. Alicia, I'm wondering if you could expand a little bit more about what we might be looking into there.
So I think a few different areas. One is the actual allocation of doses. So if there's a limited supply of malaria vaccine doses, then there's some uncertainty around whether how effective three doses of the vaccine is compared to four doses of the vaccine. And so we might fund some implementation related research to see to look at that comparative effectiveness and see whether it might be more efficient to allocate fewer doses to more places to reach more people. I think another thing is looking into opportunities to expand manufacturing capacity or other ways that we can alleviate the supply constraints. And then as I mentioned, there were these two vaccines, RTSS and then R21, coming out. There's been some talk of can we ensure availability of both vaccines equally so that there's a competitive market, so that having, you know, availability of both vaccines can ensure or keep prices a bit lower for both vaccines. I think a lot of other people are already talking about this or have efforts around like shaping the market for these vaccines. And so I think the main thing we would be doing is looking at what people are already doing and whether there is a place for additional funding to plug in.
Mm-hmm. Great. That's those are really interesting angles that we could work on. Now, kind of bringing a few different threads together, we have a few questions about how kind of vaccines, SMC, and malaria nets can all work together, or how the existence of other malaria interventions impacts the existence of other malaria interventions.
Okay, I can say a little bit about that. And what I'd like to sort of stress is to think of these interventions in terms of what prevents malaria, and then what happens when a child or an adult does get malaria and then needs to have a diagnosis, treatment, and then follow up. I think if you think about it in those two domains. So within the prevention domain is what you stressed, you know, NETs, indoor residual spraying, drug-based tools like season malaria chemo prevention and the malaria vaccine. I think what I think increasingly we are appreciating is that within that spectrum is how to select the best combination that gives you the maximum impact. You know, the paradigm may not be in every location, you give all these tools, you know, in all these tools to prevent, but I think what is likely to be more consistent going forward is that of these preventive tools, what combination gives you the best impact for the funding that is available in a particular location, so that tailoring will be taking place in different settings, but in addition, as settings change transmission intensity, so a location which may have been high transmission intensity, high risk, as that transitions to lower intensity, lower risk, the combination of preventive tools may be slightly different. So I think that's something that we're all working on, and there are various terminologies that are used for that. And so it's important to continue having those preventive tools, be they the ones we currently use, but other ones that are coming on board, like Alicia is commenting. And then once an adult or a child then gets malaria, it is critical that is diagnosed as soon as possible and treated. And in that domain, you have the diagnostics, rapid diagnostic tests, microscopy, and then you have the effective drugs that are then used for that treatment. And here we're only talking about what's called falciparum malaria. There's other malarias that have more complex treatment and diagnostic algorithms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another SMC question that's coming through is whether we're seeing any resistance patterns emerging, which would mean that we might need to change or adapt the medicines that we provide as the preventative medication in SMC?
So again, I could tackle that. I think we've got to look at these things as a continuum. I think the goal has got to be, we need to get rid of this disease. We've got to get a world that's free of malaria. That's got to be the goal. And if you keep that goal in mind, then we've got to have a pipeline of tools. So whatever tool we're using now that is effective, we've got to have a healthy pipeline of, you know, new tools that ensure that we're continuing to maintain the effectiveness and potentially even improve it. Now, some of these tools are getting more expensive in terms of their unit costs, which then means that the impact that we need out of those tools is probably going to be even greater, or the combination. So I think the critical thing, irrespective of whether we have to to, you know, it's not a discussion as to whether we should think about resistance or not, because resistance will happen. Mm-hmm. But we can't say, because resistance is going to happen, we shouldn't be doing the best we can to save the lives that are at risk now. What we need to be having, and I think philanthropy is supporting, all the foundations are supporting this, is that we need a pipeline of healthy drugs for SMC, for preventive tools, vaccines. That pipeline is essential so that we eliminate this disease and have a world that's free of malaria.
Yeah, that makes sense. So basically kind of recognizing that resistance might happen, but staying one step ahead and continuing to innovate there.
Exactly. We need to be ahead of the parasite. We need to be ahead of a mosquito. And so we've got to have that pipeline. So yes, resistance is emerging. We've seen that for insecticides. We are seeing that for treatments. We are, you know, going to see that for some of the drugs we're using. But that shouldn't be the viewpoint, that we shouldn't be doing what we can now to save lives, because we need a healthy pipeline of the next generation of tools that can allow us to continue saving lives.
Definitely, yeah, that makes sense. There's a question here that I think Grace might be well positioned to answer, surrounding how GiveWell models the impact of SMC, comparing lives saved and the benefits that come from averting a case of malaria, even if that case luckily wouldn't have been lethal.
Yeah, so we incorporate many types of benefits into our cost effectiveness model. The three main drivers of the sort of like headline cost effectiveness estimate are the benefits that we measure from our estimates of how many deaths, malaria deaths, will be averted by delivering this program. We also include an estimate of how many deaths will be indirectly averted by delivering this program. So as a result of the improved health of the population, that we may see additional benefits from averting additional mortality. We include benefits from reduced morbidity associated with having malaria, and then benefits that we call development benefits, which are estimates that we include of how much a child's income might increase later in life as a result of not having had a bunch of malaria episodes as a child. So those are really the main drivers of the cost effectiveness estimate that we have in our model.
Mm-hmm. Great. And kind of what does that cost effectiveness model get us to in terms of about how much it costs to save a life?
Yeah, great question. I can pull that up.
While Grace does that, maybe we can, does she have it?
Yeah, so as we were talking about earlier, it varies a lot across geographies. But in the four countries that we supported with the grant that we were discussing earlier, it ranges from around $2,000 to around $7,000 to save a life.
Great, that's a really low cost, and it's great that we have that opportunity, but not so great that opportunity still exists. Kind of when we think about SMC and how we can continue to understand the benefits, I'm wondering, this might be a question for, you know, either James or Grace. I'm wondering how Malaria Consortium is able to fund the monitoring activities that they do to make sure that the SMC is being distributed in the way that it needs to be, or in the way that it should be. Does GiveWell consider monitoring and evaluation grants to our charities, or are they funded another way?
Grace, do you want to take that first?
Yeah, so I would just say that in general, GiveWell really values paying for information that will enable us to improve our cost effectiveness estimates. And so embedded in the grants that we make to Malaria Consortium to support program delivery is also funding to support the associated monitoring. And we've also been quite supported, quite excited to provide an additional amount of support to Malaria Consortium annually that they can use as sort of a discretionary research budget. And so that's not the sort of standard M&E that we've been talking about. That is a budget that they can use to answer targeted research questions about how best to deliver SMC or how SMC will perform in new contexts. So yeah, I mean, we find all of that information incredibly valuable, and compared to the costs of delivering the programs, the amount of money that's going into delivery, it's really not a whole lot. And so yeah, the value of it is very high to us.
Yeah, and I think that's where we resonate as an organization and as in a partnership with yourselves, is the sort of the value that you put on data and the opportunity you give us to really work at the forefront of ensuring that with our partners, our government partners and communities, we're able to really get the right data, the right information, and where possible, strengthen the systems. So yes, I would say, Olivia, it's a core part of the program, and we're delighted that GiveWell continues to value information and data, as well as when we have gaps, being able to discuss those with yourselves and you know our other stakeholders, Global Fund, etc., through the SMC Alliance, to identify gaps and then how can we address those gaps collectively.
Yeah, it's been a great opportunity for GiveWell to be able to work with all of these organizations that are focused on this same really important goal. So it's about time to wrap up. Thank you so much to James, Grace, and Alicia for sharing. I know that I learned a lot. I hope that the attendees did as well. And we really appreciate all of you attending and asking your great questions. If you have any further questions or things that we didn't get to, feel free to reach out to info@givewell.org. And thank you so much for your support of GiveWell's malaria programs, as well as the other charities we support.